Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How confident are you that you can enjoy a middle-class lifestyle, own a decent home, retire comfortably, and raise your children to expect even greater prosperity? Many of us were brought up to view the American dream almost as a right for anyone willing to work hard and follow the rules. But events in recent years have proven there are no guarantees and that some aspects of a financially stable existence are actually getting harder for ordinary people to achieve and sustain. Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Hedrick Smith explores how the game has changed and how it affects us all in his new book, Who Stole the American Dream? Hedrick, welcome to Think.
Nice to be with you, Chris. Thanks.
What you describe here is sort of an economically bifurcated America where the two branches are growing ever farther apart. Can you give us an overview of the growing divide?
Well, it's striking. The difference between America today and America in the 40s, 50s, and 60s. When I start out to write this book, I didn't have the same title in mind. I had in mind a title like The Dream at Risk. I knew, as we all do, that the middle class is in trouble. People have lost their jobs. They've lost their homes. They've seen, even before the Great Recession, jobs being shipped overseas. There's a sense of economic insecurity and people worried about whether or not they can afford their retirement. And I wanted to figure out what happened. How did this happen? And when I went back into it, I began to find out some things that maybe I should have known as a correspondent and bureau chief for the New York Times in Washington back in the 70s and the 80s, but I kept learning new things. And one of the things that I learned, which is absolutely central to the question that you asked, is this. From 1945 till 1973, wages and salaries of middle-class people in America rose kind of hand-in-hand with increasing productivity and with the nation's growth. That's what you expect. Productivity rose roughly 97% in those 28 years, and the average worker's pay rose 95%. So almost dollar for dollar, the prosperity that was generated in this country was shared with the middle class and also obviously with the bosses and the owners and the investors. But the picture changed radically in the mid-70s. We didn't see it at the time. It takes quite a while to understand these trends and recognize them. But looking back, you can see that from 1973 to 2011, the productivity of the American workforce continued to grow, not quite as fast, but it continued to grow roughly 80%. But the wage, the hourly wage of the typical worker in America, and not just assembly line workers, but computer programmers, middle class people, salespeople, whatever, all through the economy, the average hourly pay grew only 4%. And if you toss in the benefits, benefits too, 10%. So 10% gain in terms of standard of living versus an 80% gain in terms of the productivity of the workforce. That means the money went somewhere else. The money went into corporate profits. The money went into stock options and much ballooning salaries for the CEOs, went into tremendous gains for Wall Street, tremendous gains for investors. So the middle class lost out. What we had before was shared prosperity, the kind of dream you were describing at the beginning, steady job, rising income, health benefits, secure retirement, and a better future for your kids. And we don't have that today. And that's the big, big change that's taking place in this country.
So people know it wasn't always this way. You've alluded to this. In the early part of the 20th century, Henry Ford vowed that he would pay his workers a decent enough wage that they could afford the product that they were building. And that philosophy really spread.
Yeah, I think people do sense, and I sensed it when I started out, I sensed that there were problems. But I have to tell you, the more I dug into it, the more I was impressed that when you put the pattern together and the picture together, it was much, much worse than I had realized. The numbers are staggering. But let's talk about Henry Ford. Henry Ford had the idea that paying workers was not only fairer and more socially just, it was smart business. Pay them well, they can afford to buy your product, as you just put it. Pay the assembly line workers, they can buy a Model T. I'll sell more cars. A lot of people bought that. They bought that for 30 or 40 years in the American economy. I'm talking about just not ordinary people, but the heads of General Motors, General Electric, Exxon Mobil, the biggest corporations in America. They were signing agreements with trade unions that guaranteed steadily rising wages, pretty secure jobs, certainly benefits, health benefits, and pension benefits. And all that enabled people to buy their homes and help fund better education for their kids and a better future for their kids. It's called the virtuous circle of growth by economists. And what they mean is high pay delivers high consumer demand. And contrary to the public debate about what generates a growing economy in America today, contrary to what is being said, what generates it is consumer demand. That's about 70% of the driving force of the American economy. We're having a weak, slow, jobless recovery, not, in my opinion, primarily because of President Obama's policies, but because business isn't hiring, business isn't expanding, and they're not doing it because people don't have enough money to spend. Demand is low, it's weak. And each time we have a recession, 1990s, early 2000s, now, the jobless recovery takes longer and longer to come back to where it was before, and the reason is weak consumer demand. Low pay means low demand, means low growth.
So by mid-century, Hedrick, CEOs were doing well in the U.S., but the income gap between highest and lowest paid workers in the average corporation was at the smallest point it would ever be. What did that mean in practical terms for American families?
You know, what's interesting is whenever you live in a country, in a society, you sort of assume as though history was always this way, and that when people tell you it was different before, either worse, as in the Great Depression, or better, in what people call the Great Compression, that is where people's salaries and wages at the top and the bottom and the middle of America were closer together, I tend to be skeptical. But in fact, when you go back and you look at the facts, there's plenty of evidence to say that was there. The difference between Charlie Wilson's pay, and Charlie Wilson ran General Motors back in the 1950s, which was the biggest corporation in America. And so at that time, the biggest corporation tended to get the guy with the highest salary. He made about $600,000. Translated into today's dollars, that would be $5 million. Today, $5 million as a pay for a top executive, it puts them at the low end of the pay scale by far. I mean, you have people walking away with hundreds of millions of dollars a year in stock options. Larry Ellison at Oracle, Michael Weisner at Disney, others. I mean, literally, Sandy Weill at Citigroup, the bank. They were making hundreds of millions of dollars a year. So Charlie Wilson would be a piker. Charlie Wilson made about 40 times the average worker's pay. Today, the CEO of a large company makes about 360 times the average worker's pay. So the difference is multiplied 9 times. The worker's pay is about the same, adjusted for inflation. The CEO's pay has gone through the roof.
And I, not to be too glib about this, but I guess there are only so many yachts and Bentleys one can buy. A lot of that money ends up either banked or invested, as opposed to put back to work purchasing products and putting people on the payroll.
I don't know where you go. I'm always astonished when I go to places where there are harbors and there are yachts at the number of the yachts. I mean, the size of the yachts, the vacations people go on, the 10,000, 20,000, 30,000, 40,000 square foot homes there are, the private clubs there are all over the place. Citigroup put out a slick investment brochure back in 2005 to its top-end investors. And its advice was, don't bother investing in companies that cater to the middle class and even the upper middle class. The wealth is all in the top 1 or 2%. That's where the money is to be made. If you want to make smart investments, do that. Advertising Age said 40% of the wealth in America was there. They gave the same advice. Citigroup said we have the greatest concentration of wealth since 16th century Spain and 17th century Holland. I mean, Americans don't realize we're way, way out of whack historically, even with our own past.
So let's talk about the end of this expansion between the 1940s and the 1970s, when the middle class was quite robust. At the same time, or toward the end of that time, you have the rise of Barry Goldwater, who fights actively against the power of labor unions, against the size of government, and essentially lays the groundwork for what we have today more than 40 years later.
No question. I mean, the Tea Party politics today, if you read the speeches Sometimes they're almost verbatim, but they certainly are very much out of the page of Barry Goldwater. I mean, the conservative right-wing Republican movement in America has been enormously successful in terms of going from being a minority where Goldwater really lost the presidency badly to Lyndon Johnson in 1964, and to a situation today where a lot of the political discourse is dominated by Barry Goldwater's ideas. What people don't realize, in fact, I had really not appreciated it myself until I went back and looked at the record, is how much the Republican Party has changed. I'm not exactly a fan of Richard Nixon. Richard Nixon tapped my telephone. I was one of the enemies of the Nixon administration. But when I went back and looked, Nixon was a moderate compared to today's Republicans. I mean, he established the Environmental Protection Agency, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, mine safety laws, traffic safety laws. He believed that he was a fan of corporate captains of industry. He loved hobnobbing with businessmen. He took their political support, welcomed it, but he felt that he had to curb the excesses of capitalism, in part because of public pressures from the environmental movement, the consumer movement, and so forth. Huge change. Barry Goldwater could hardly stand Nixon and could hardly stand Eisenhower. And I think today's Tea Party Republicans and maybe even Mitt Romney, I don't know, probably feel the same way about them. So the Republican Party has changed tremendously, and it's opened a terrific gap in this country. The Democratic Party has changed, too. Both the parties have become more polarized, and that makes it much harder to get anything done in Washington.
What sort of influence did Ralph Nader have at around the same time that Goldwater was sort of reaching his apex?
Well, Nader comes along later, and Nader had tremendous influence. And he wrote this book, Unsafe at Any Speed, in which he attacked General Motors and said General Motors and the American auto companies were basically producing cars with defects that were causing accidents. And there was a public outrage at that, and gave a shot in the arm to the consumer movement and led to all kinds of regulations to make safer products, to label products more honestly and more openly. I mean, most of us, when we go shopping today, we look at labels and so forth. We can really give the Ralph Nader and the consumer movement of the 1970s a lot of the credit for that. So they had tremendous influence, but then it ran out. I mean, what happened was business got organized and had a counterattack in the late 1970s under Jimmy Carter, which is interesting. It happened under the Democrats, not under Republicans, and then under Ronald Reagan. And business has really dominated the political landscape, particularly in Washington, ever since then. And Nader never got to his fondest dream, which was to set up a consumer protection agency. I mean, that took all the way to Barack Obama before that happened. And Nader was defeated by the lobbyists for business back in the late 1970s in the famous Congress of 1978.
Tell us about Lewis Powell.
That is one of the great surprises of my book and one of the great surprises of my reporting. I was the bureau chief of the New York Times in Washington in 1978, the 1970s, late 1970s into the 1980s. And I know, and all of us reporters know, that there are gaps in our reporting. There are things we miss. We're writing history on the fly. We're doing salami-sized history. And so it's going to be later on when the historians come back and put the full record together and tell us what happened. But boy, I sure miss Lewis Powell. Lewis Powell, of course, was for 17, 18 years a Supreme Court justice. He was a corporate attorney from Richmond, Virginia.
You know what? Let me jump in here. Actually, I set you up and now we're going to take a quick break. So I want to make sure you have time to tell the whole story. My guest this hour is Pulitzer Prize winning journalist Hedrick Smith. We're talking about his new book, Who Stole the American Dream? You can join the conversation by calling in to 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can study a variety of topics such as creative writing, human rights, and the arts. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Hedrick Smith, whose new book is called Who Stole the American Dream? Join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Hedrick, before the break, you were about to tell us about Lewis Powell, who was not necessarily an imposing figure if you were to run into him on the street or, in fact, even in court.
Yeah, he would pat around the Supreme Court building in soft shoes. Some people thought he was a custodian or something like that when they ran into him in the Supreme Court building. Quiet, soft-spoken, tidewater drawl. You folks in Texas would be very comfortable listening to Lewis Powell. He came from Richmond, Virginia, was a longtime corporate attorney and head of the ABA, the American Bar Association, at one point. So he was an important corporate attorney. But not exactly until he went on the Supreme Court, a major figure in American life. And I got to tell you, I missed the Powell story totally, and so did all the reporters of our generation. Lewis Powell was a great defender of the American free enterprise system. And in 1971, he was terribly exercised at what was going on. He said that the free enterprise system was under assault from Ralph Nader and the consumer activists, from government regulations. And by the way, interesting, he was talking about the regulations of Richard Nixon, the Republican president who was just about to name Powell to the Supreme Court. He didn't use Nixon's name, but he said business has got to organize, it's got to get tough, it's got to get aggressive, it's got to punish its enemies, it needs to pour money, it needs to have a long-term plan for taking over a political system and defending the free enterprise system from assault. Well, wow. He turned out to be a corporate Paul Revere. He gave this memo to the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, which circulated it to tens of thousands of businesses, and it lit a prairie fire. It's unbelievable. The number of offices that corporations had in Washington jumped from 175 in 1971 to over 2,000 a decade later. The Chamber of Commerce doubled its staff, tripled its income. The National Federation of Independent Business, the small business organization, went from 3,000 members to 600,000 members in a decade. The National Association of Manufacturing moved its headquarters to Washington. The Business Roundtable, which is the most powerful political arm of the major corporations in America, was formed within a year of Lewis Powell's memo and set up shop. By 1980, there were 50,000 employees of corporate trade associations. There were 130 corporate lobbyists for every single member of Congress. So this memo just triggered an enormous business rebellion, and it was a potent force. When Jimmy Carter was in office, it absolutely turned the tables on the American labor movement, on Ralph Nader and the consumer movement. It turned around Jimmy Carter's legislation. The 1978 Congress, which is largely ignored by many historians and virtually unknown to most people and to most journalists, in my opinion, was the watershed Congress, the pivotal Congress. You can see all kinds of things turning around in American politics in that Congress, and business making enormous gains. Kind of like sports. You know, in sports, whether it's a tennis match or a football game or whatever it is, the teams are battling and struggling to get ahead of each other. And there's a moment or there's a time or there's a play that takes place, and it's a game changer. The whole atmosphere, the whole psychology of the game changes, and one side goes ahead and wins. That's what happened in 1978. Business scored several successive, very important victories, and as Arthur Levitt, who was then the head of the American Stock Exchange, later head of the Securities and Exchange Commission, said to me, business saw it could win, it could get what they wanted, business tasted victory, and from then on, that's what we were after. And it has changed American politics since then. The next 30 years, including today, are dominated by the forces that Lewis Powell set to work. The lobbyists in Washington for corporate America today could be called Lewis Powell's army.
So we have lots of folks who want to get into this conversation. But before we get there, I do want to talk about one other aspect. This, to me, was perhaps the most fascinating section of the book, and that is the issues that we now have as we face retirement in this country. Let's start with this. Changes to the bankruptcy law in the 1970s, how did they play into the security of corporate pension programs?
Well, the changes in the bankruptcy, this happened, by the way, in the 1978 Congress, which also passed the 401k plan, mm-hmm. which was never intended to be what it's turned out to be, which is the major retirement system in America today. But in terms of what you just asked, the 1978 bankruptcy law gave corporate management more control over the fate of the corporation in bankruptcy. Prior to that, most corporations that went bankrupt were turned over to what is called a bankruptcy trustee, and that trustee, who was sort of neutral, not in favor of management, not in favor of labor, ran the process and decided who was going to take the hits, who was going to lose money, who was going to keep money, who was going to hang on to their jobs, and so forth. And that generated a kind of a fairer outcome. Everybody took a hit. Everybody took the pain. The new bankruptcy law left the existing management in control, and the existing management imposed very tough conditions. I mean, you see one bankruptcy after another in the airlines, in the steel industry, and other industries in which trade unions and ordinary workers take enormous losses in their salaries, and their working conditions, and particularly in their health care and their pensions. So there is enormous impact on middle-class standard of living from that bankruptcy law, and almost nobody, and I'll admit it again, I wasn't covering economics, I was mostly covering national security and that kind of stuff, but I don't remember anybody in the New York Times talking about the importance of that bankruptcy law, and nobody, absolutely nobody, recognized what the 401k system was when it was written into law in 1978. It was written into law as a favor to Kodak and Xerox, who wanted a tax shelter for deferred compensation for their executives. And then it got turned around later on. We can get into that if you want to. But so many things happened in that Congress that affected our lives in the future. The lid on interest rates, which became absolutely crucial to the housing boom and bust, the lid on interest rates was blown off by that 1978 Congress. Amazing stuff. And as I say, as a reporter who worked at the time, I'm embarrassed to admit how much I had to learn when I went back and read the history and did the reporting.
Well, is it reasonable to assume that the people who put these measures in place couldn't have imagined what the impact would be?
No, I think the people who wrote the bankruptcy law and worked with Congress to write the bankruptcy law were corporate advisors, and they knew exactly what they were doing. I think the people who wrote the 401k provisions knew what they were doing for themselves. They had no idea that it was gonna go further. The people who blew the lid off the interest rates, the banks and so forth, I think they knew exactly what they were doing. So it's different in one case after another. The people who got rid of the lid on interest rates understood that if instead of having a limit to, say, 8 or 9% interest rates, if they could go up to 20% on mortgages, then they could start to sell mortgages to people who really couldn't afford to buy houses because they could afford to take the risk because they were making so much money from the interest rate. So they knew what they were doing. They were setting up the subprime market that eventually became so explosive.
Okay, so 401ks. I think you and I, Hedrick, are about a generation apart. Most workers my age and younger have no other provision even suggested to them besides a 401k to save for retirement. Talk about what these were meant to be and why they are unlikely to work out the way even those of us socking money into them have been told they would.
Yeah. Well, you do have to understand that workers from my generation, 84% of them, 6 out of 7 workers for any company over 100 employees, in 1980, had guaranteed lifetime pensions. They would get a monthly paycheck from their employer as long as they lived. Put that together with Social Security, and for most middle-class people, that was a secure retirement. Now, the 401k takes that burden off the company and puts it on the individual, and the companies were delighted. Not initially. Initially, the companies weren't for that. But as they began to understand that they were going to get rid of hundreds of billions of dollars of retirement costs, then they said, whoa, that's really going to help profits. Let's shift the burden over to the employees. And even if we have an employer match, it's only going to cost us about one-third as much as the old lifetime pensions. Mm-hmm. What's going on in the 401ks is this. If you're going to save for your retirement, you have to start early. You have to start in your 30s, and you have to plug away at it for 30 years. You have to put the money in good times and bad times. You have to put the maximum amount of money in that you can, and you have to have your employer maximize it. The best programs put about 9% in, 6% from the employee and 3% from the employers. When I've talked to financial advisors, they say you really should be socking away 12 to 15% every year. So the initial input, even if it's high, isn't high enough. The next problem is when people get in trouble, they tend to borrow. If you borrow from your rainy day fund, use it as a rainy day fund, it's not there when you retire. Almost everybody who loses a job or moves from one job to another, most people cash out. So the retirement fund disappears entirely. Then come along the Great Recession, and people stop putting money into their savings. They should be putting more money in then because the stock prices and the things you're investing in are lower. But everybody's instinct when they're bad times is sit on your money. Don't put it in your retirement fund. And by the way, the companies did the same thing. Hundreds of big companies stopped matching the funds. So they don't build up. And they have to build up slowly over time. The average 401k balance, you won't believe it, today is $18,000. Hmm. The average balance of people on the verge of retirement in their 60s is $85,000. That sounds like a lot. But if you made $50,000 a year before you retired, the financial experts will tell you you need somewhere between $400,000 and $500,000 to last for your lifetime. What's happened is we're living longer. We need more medical care. Inflation's going to eat up some of our retirement savings. We need much more savings than we needed before, and we don't know how to do it. Most people don't know how to invest wisely. They don't stick at it. It's a disaster waiting to explode, I hate to say.
Hedrick Smith is with us. His new book is Who Stole the American Dream? Our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. Email address is think@kera.org. Lynn in Grapevine writes, being at the tail end of the baby boomer generation, my husband and I have decided that our retirement will be spent in another country where our money will provide for a comfortable living and health care is assured. It pains me to say, but I believe that our son's futures will also likely be better off in another country and not the U.S. This is sad, but the capitalist political culture in this country is not interested in citizenship. What do you think about that, Hedrick?
I think that is a devastating comment. I mean, that is one of the saddest things. This is literally one of the saddest things I've ever heard about America, that Americans would come to the conclusion, intelligent Americans would come to the conclusion that they would be better off in their retirement and the kids would be better off in another country. I mean, that I hate to say there's a good reason for their saying that, but I mean, that's just terrible to think that we've gotten to that point in this country. And this is not to be emotional. I mean, you need to look at the facts. The facts are really deeply disturbing. That's very upsetting.
What about, you know, companies who say we might like to have considered this, but we will literally go under if we continued these kinds of pension obligations that we set up? Why are those funds so poorly invested in?
Well, let's stick with the companies at first. I mean, the companies are saying, and we just had a case, Caterpillar Tractor, the big farm equipment manufacturer in Peoria, Illinois, just signed a contract with its trade unions, and it imposed a wage freeze. Now, this is a company that had record profits of $4.9 billion in 2011. Now, those profits are going to go somewhere, and you know where they're going to go. They're going to go to the investors, most of them on Wall Street, most of them part of the financial elite, the 1%, the 2%, the 3%, and they're going to go in stock options to the executives, which means those folks at the top of the pile are going to make more money, and the people who are making the tractors and so forth are going to be stuck where they are, and with inflation, they're actually going to go backwards. That's what's been going on here, you know, for 30 years or so. Now, the companies are saying, if we don't do it, we'll go out of business. Well, I don't entirely believe it. Let's move to another area. Let's move to retail. Mm-hmm. Walmart told its employees recently that it couldn't afford its health benefits that it was giving them. It was going to have to cut out health benefits entirely for part-time workers. It was going to have to reduce health benefits for full-time workers considerably. They were going to have to contribute more. And they had a big rollback. And they said, we cannot afford to do this. Move next door to Costco. The CEO is Jim Sinegal. He takes about $2 million a year in pay versus $20 million a year in pay for the Walmart CEO. He says we have an obligation to our workers. We have to provide them with health care. We need workers in a community where we're not dumping our workers on the community's health care services. We have an obligation to our community. Now, both those companies have got to compete in the world, and Walmart is telling you, we can't compete, and Costco is saying we can compete, and we're going to commit ourselves to our employees. I think the facts are the same. There's a different corporate attitude. Now change and go to Germany. Germany faces the same global competitive conditions that we do. Germany has, the German employers have increased middle class worker pay since 1985, five times as fast as in America. There are still 21% of workers in America, in Germany, in manufacturing. People in America say we can't keep manufacturing. We've got to become a service economy. It's hopeless. China and India and the Asian tigers are going to take all the manufacturing away from us. We have 9% of our workforce in manufacturing. Germany has 21%. How come? Same economic conditions. I say there are different attitudes. There are different leaders. There's a different track record. Germany, in 10 years, in the 2000s, Germany had a $2 trillion export surplus. They shipped more goods to the world than they bought. Now, they're a very high-priced, high-skilled people who demand high-quality products. They want the best in the world, but they were able to ship more than they bought. We had a $6 trillion trade surplus. Same world, same China, same India. What's going on here? I don't believe it's the external forces. I don't believe the answer. We'd go under if we didn't do this. I think there are comparisons to be made that suggest it's more profitable, it's easier, and the elite is making more money.
It's even interesting to think about Germany as compared with the rest of the EU in these very troubled times.
Well, Germany's been an enormously successful economy. It's the only European economy that's bounced back significantly from the recession. But it has a model which favors, we were talking about it earlier, stakeholder capitalism. The job of the business is to take care of, yes, the investors, yes, the shareholders, but also, yes, the employees, and also, yes, the communities in which we have factories, in which we have banks or outlets, or whatever it is. There's a different attitude. There's a different ethos. And there was in America. This is not German. This is not European. This is not socialism. This is American capitalism in an earlier period. And those people believed that they were doing the best thing in the world. And Richard Nixon, Republican, vice president to Dwight Eisenhower, goes to Moscow, has a debate with Nikita Khrushchev, the Soviet communist leader, and says, we have a classless society in America. We have what communism dreams about.
Hedrick Smith is with us. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author of the new book, Who Stole the American Dream? We will take your calls after this. The number is 1-800-933-5372. Our email address is think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a graduate education flexible enough to allow you to explore what matters most to you. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Hedrick Smith is with us. His new book is called Who Stole the American Dream? Our number is 1-800-933-5372, and that's where we find Jeremy on the line in Dallas. Hi, Jeremy.
Oh, good day. I really like your show.
Thank you.
And compliments to the guest because he hit the nail right on the head. However, we must broaden our perspective. What he's talking about is actually a global problem. There is a global culture that exists of the same stature. Now, meaning that your dictatorships saw it so much better, they could be so much marvelous, they've adopted this way of being that our country or our leaders have allowed our country this elitist form of existence. Now, it bothers me. I'm very disparaged because you've got this 3% or 5% ruling globally, and I believe it's like a cancer. In fact, it's so much so, I'm not so much worried about the population of the Earth going to 8, 9 million people. I think that cancer of this global elitist is going to destroy us.
What do you think about that, Hedrick?
Well, I think there probably are elites in other countries that are similar in mind, certainly some people similar in mind to corporate elites in America. But what is really striking is that the disparity of income in America is far greater than in other countries. It's much greater than it is in most European countries. We are much less the land of opportunity than we used to be, particularly compared to European countries. There are a number of studies that are out in recent years that show it's easier to move up from the bottom to the middle or the middle to the top or just move up the line in Germany, in France, in Scandinavia, and other countries than it is in America. If you go back 30 or 40 years, the amount of power and wealth that the top 1% had in America was actually less than the power and wealth, percentage of power and wealth that the top 1% had in Germany, in Japan, in France, in Australia, in New Zealand, and so forth. That's completely reversed today. We have by far the greatest concentration of wealth in America, and along with it, political power of the modern advanced countries. The Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development, 34 most modern nations in the world, said the U.S. has, the U.S. ranks 31st, I think it is, or 32nd in terms of the fairness of distribution of income. The only countries that are worse in the membership of the OECD are Chile and Mexico. So we've become like a banana republic, at least economically. And while there are some global trends in that direction, they're nowhere near as severe elsewhere as they are in America. The numbers don't show that.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next with Ron in Fort Worth. Hi, Ron.
Hey, Chris. Great show. Love it. Hey, question for you. I've been in the manufacturing business here in the DFW area for about 30 years. I stupidly didn't outsource to China, which my better, smarter competitors did. My questions are, when is it that, and I realize this is a bipartisan thing, NAFTA, GATT, and the sort of conversion of tax laws that really incentivize any rational businessman to make products overseas and import them back into the country, keep the profit offshore, and fire his employees? Give us the history on that movement.
Well, there's absolutely no question that we have perverse incentives at work in our economy. We got tax laws that absolutely reward people for making profit overseas rather than making profit in America. You have American companies that operate in America, companies that have to, like hotels and trucking companies and so forth, that do all their business in America. They're paying corporate taxes at very close to the official corporate tax rate of 35%. But if you take big multinationals like General Electric or Boeing or IBM or Apple, which is the prime case, Apple is by far the prime case, and they do all their manufacturing overseas. Apple has essentially 700,000 employees overseas in China. They don't work for Apple. They work for a subcontractor that produces all the iPads, all the iPhones, everything for China. And they have 30,000 retail employees here selling them at Apple centers around the store. Apple's tax rate is down somewhere around 10 or 12%. General Electric made something like $10 billion from 2004 to 2006. It not only didn't pay taxes, it got a tax rebate from the federal government of $4.5 billion. Of course, what this gentleman says is correct. And then you add to that, Craig Barrett, the head of Intel, says, I can go over to China and I can get $1 billion in subsidies in free land, in cheap highways, in low-cost infrastructure and tax write-offs. It's $1 billion cheaper for me to build a fab plant, chip fabricating plant, in China than it is in America. That's all about government rules, subsidies, and so forth. We have been really foolish, and I agree with this gentleman. It's not one party or the other party. You know, we just simply don't have intelligent rules that incentivize people to keep their work here, and we penalize the people who do. It's a stupid system, but you've got to fix the tax system, among many other things, and you also have to go to the World Trade Organization and say China's cheating, because China is cheating on world trade rules, and that's one of the reasons why companies are doing what the same's competitors are doing. We simply have to get smart and tough.
Hedrick, what about corporate strategists who say, look, if Apple were to move its manufacturing to the United States, then, you know, an iPad costs $2,800 and Americans want that iPad, but they don't want to spend more than $600 or $700?
Well, the real question would be whether or not, in fact, over time, the cost difference would be as much. Hmm. When companies first started to go to China in the 1980s, the wage differential was that great. but it's not that great now. There are other costs, transportation costs, capital costs, and so forth. I think Apple's doing it because it doesn't have the capital costs. I don't think the labor costs are the key things anymore. It's the capital costs. It's what I was just talking about. I mean, if you talk to people, for example, a guy named Clyde Prestowitz, who's an economist who acts as an advisor to Intel and a number of other major corporations. I mean, he says flat out, if you sit in those discussions, you understand that the top corporate leadership in these major multinationals is making decisions based on what the capital costs are going to be. The labor costs don't really figure in at all. The national public debate on this issue is way off the mark. It's not where the heads of the corporate leaders are.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to Thomas calling from Dallas. Hi, Thomas.
Great time to come into the conversation. I just want to say that it sounds ironic, but actually raising capital gains and raising the top marginal tax rate would be the best thing to bring manufacturing back here. Hiring, training, pensions, capital investment are all deductible. And so the higher the tax rate, the greater the flight to those avenues. We have all the consumers, so people won't leave. High cap gains means you get a high depreciation on your capital plants. Low cap gains means it's cheap to liquidate it. Low top income taxes mean the corporate executives get to take all the booty from the liquidation of the capital. The managers of these firms don't have the same interest as the stockholders, the firms themselves, the workers, or the economy generally. You get low cap production with low tax rates. High tax rates, the capital intensive producers actually fare better.
What do you think, Hedrick?
Amen. Amen. I mean, this gentleman is talking a lot more sense than people realize. We're told again and again that if we would just lower taxes, we get growth. Okay, let's just take a look at that proposition. We had the lowest tax rates, individual tax rates and corporate tax rates during the years 2000 to 2010 that we've had in American history for the last 70 years, except for one brief period under Reagan. When taxes went down, they went back up again. We had the slowest growth rate. And go back to the 1950s and the 1960s, the maximum tax rate under Dwight Eisenhower was, listen to this, you won't believe it, 92%. Today it's 35. Under John F. Kennedy, 77%. Today it's 35. We had much better growth during the Eisenhower and Kennedy years than we've had in the George W. Bush years. The conversation about tax rates and how they affect growth is just way off the mark. What matters is consumer spending power. Consumer spending accounts for 70% of the driving force behind the American economy. Yes, of course we need capital. Yes, of course we need some people saving their money. But business has been sitting on nearly $2 trillion of capital since the depths of the recession, and it hasn't been investing much in new plant and equipment. The problem isn't shortage of capital. The problem isn't tax rates. The problem is average people don't have enough money to spend. There's not enough demand in our economy, so we're having a slow jobless recovery. This is the third slow jobless recovery we've had in a row, and each time it happens, it takes longer to get back to where we were before. There's something structurally wrong. And the political dialogue isn't even looking at it.
I've got an email here from Lydia in Arlington who writes, I graduated with a bachelor's degree last year and have been underemployed since. I was told all my life that if I just worked hard enough or took advantage of all the opportunities that things would fall into place. Needless to say, this has been a disenchanting year. Lydia's question is there any hope for the U.S. economy? Can we change the trends you've been talking about?
Yeah, there is, but we're going to have to recognize what the problems are. I mean, what I just said is very important. It's consumer demand that is the problem. So we need to express our outrage and our concern when companies like Caterpillar impose a wage freeze on their workers while they have record profits. That's got to be unacceptable. We need to change the laws. Corporate chiefs are walking away with enormous amounts of money on stock options. And by the way, they're cheating like crazy. They've been cheating like crazy. They backdate the options. They manipulate them. It's not against the law to do that. You can cheat your own shareholders, and it's not against the law. We need to fix those laws. We ought to have special taxes on those stock options. So there's not the same incentive to do what? To drive the stock price of your company up instead of to hire more people and to sell more goods. I mean, there are all kinds of crazy incentives that we have in our system now, which are not designed to make America grow and to share the prosperity. They're designed to help line the pockets of the financial elite.
Do you think it's appropriate, if very sad, that a lot of Americans seem to feel really powerless in all this?
I don't think it's appropriate, but I understand it. I mean, it's frustrating. It's very understandable. Listen, if you look at polls over the last 20 years, very consistently in poll after poll, roughly 80% of the people say lobbyists in Washington have too much power. Washington doesn't listen to people like me. Can you pass legislation in Washington to curb the power of lobbyists? No, why not? Because the lobbyists have so much power, they'll block it. When they tried to pass legislation to try to fix the banking system so we don't have another blow-up as we did in 2008, the banks in Wall Street hired over 1,400 former government officials, former members of Congress, former majority leaders in both the House and Senate, former staff members on congressional committees to help block the legislation and made sure that whatever was in the legislation didn't curb the power of the banks. Yes, it's understandable why people feel powerless, but what has to happen is people need to remember that there was a time not too long ago when the consumerist movement, when the environmental movement, when the civil rights movement, when the labor movement, when the peace movement, all had powerful impact on policymakers in this country. But what that takes is for people to do something that they're, at the moment, reluctant to do or don't believe will make a difference. Get up off their chairs, get organized, go out in the street and say, if we bailed out the banks have got to bail out the homeowners. And if they bail out the homeowners will actually have more money to spend that will add to consumer demand to get things going. We have an infrastructure in this country that is so out of date, roads, highways, ports, airports, that the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, this is business now. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce says we're losing $1 trillion in exports because our transportation system in this country is so out of date. So we should rebuild the transportation system. And that means spending money. That means investing in our own national competitiveness. You can't move that kind of legislation through Congress now unless people start demanding it, demand the jobs. You know, there are things that could be done. There are targets that could be talked about. There are movements that could be started. But people have got to start to believe again that if the public organizes, expresses its demands, American history tells us Washington will listen and Washington will act, even people who don't agree. Richard Nixon was not an environmentalist, but he passed a lot of environmental legislation because the public demanded it.
The new book by Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Hedrick Smith is called Who Stole the American Dream? Hedrick, it's been a fascinating discussion. Thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Chrissy, you're nice to be interested, and I hope there are a few folks down in Dallas who are interested enough to go out and buy the book, not just because I want to sell books, but I think these ideas are so important. I think people understanding this, and I've done the best job I can as a reporter to try to honestly tell it, and I criticize Democrats and I criticize Republicans. It isn't a matter of partisanship. It's a matter of our getting to the bottom of understanding our problems.
Well, I appreciate your passion. Thank you so much. Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bilotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Jeff Whittington is senior producer. You can learn more about the show and including what we have planned for upcoming programs, and you can download the free daily podcast at kera.org/think. Email comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.